Good morning. I'm pleased to be able to present our work this morning on a topic that's been sort of near and dear to me, which is birth spacing, and talk a little bit about a mixed method studies that we sort of recently completed. I have no disclosures, as you heard. So what I'd like to do before I talk about birth spacing is really kind of back it up to what I think is sort of the public health problem, which is really the issue of infant mortality in this country. And so what you can see here is that the rate of infant mortality in the United States is 6.9 deaths per 1,000 live births, which is well above what was set as the Healthy People 2020 goal of 6.0 deaths per 1,000 live births. And keep in mind, as many of you know, is that that goal was actually, that bar was lowered back in 2010. The Healthy People 2010 goal was actually 4.5 deaths per 1,000 live births. But what's most striking to me is that there are these wide disparities in infant mortality, with African Americans having risk of death of an infant of approximately greater than twice that of whites. When we back up even further and sort of think about what are contributors to the infant mortality rate, the number one cause is congenital anomalies or chromosomal disorders, but that's followed pretty closely by preterm birth and low birth weight. And what we also know then clearly is that there are wide disparities in the preterm birth rate, again with African Americans having a much higher rate of infant mortality than other populations. Similarly, there are differences in sort of the consequences of preterm birth. So while I said that the number one cause of infant mortality in the country is congenital anomalies, for some populations like African Americans and Puerto Ricans, the number one cause is actually preterm birth. And preterm birth is not just about infant mortality, so there are lots of consequences of infant mortality, of preterm birth that we need to be mindful of, and those include a high risk of neonatal and infant morbidity, maternal morbidity and quality of life. So if you survey women who had a preterm birth, they are much more likely to have lower quality of life scores. They themselves are more likely to die of ischemic heart disease or stroke down the road. There's a huge economic impact, so the March of Dimes estimated that there's about a $5 billion payout by employer-based health plans to care for preterm infants. Societal consequences, so we know that infants that are born preterm are more likely to, or less likely to graduate from high school, more likely to have lower mean IQ scores later in life. And then we're learning ever more about fetal origins of adult disease, so that those infants who are born preterm are themselves more likely to go on to have a lot of adult complications. So when we think about what then contributes to the preterm birth risk, it's very clear that preterm birth is not just a single disease entity, but really is a syndrome contributed to by a number of factors. And they can be dumped into sort of a number of categories, things like biology, perhaps, inflammation in multiple gestations, the environment, things like stressors and racism, things that are considered maybe health behaviors like unintended pregnancy and substance use, and then things like healthcare, such as poor interconception health and healthcare and no prenatal care. So for myself, the things that have been most important for me to study are things like unintended pregnancy, short interpregnancy intervals, and poor interconception health and health care. So when I talk about the interpregnancy interval, because I talk about it a lot, what I mean is the length of time between the end of one pregnancy and the conception of the next pregnancy. And the care that's delivered during those intervals, we tend to talk about prenatal care as the care that's delivered during pregnancy, interconception care is the care delivered between pregnancies, and maybe preconception care is the care delivered before that first pregnancy. So what do we know about the length of the interpregnancy interval and its impact on subsequent pregnancy outcomes? So Zhu published this landmark paper in the New England Journal in 1999, where they looked at the relationship between the length of the interpregnancy interval and a large cohort of women in Utah. They found that the median interpregnancy interval, so again, between the birth of one pregnancy and conception of the next, was about 2 years, but there was a wide range, so certainly very short intervals and very long intervals seen in this large population. What they knew demographically was that the group that had the shortest intervals were more likely to be young, less likely to be white, more likely to have lower education attainment, and more likely to be single. And those women who are on the longer end of the curve are more likely, as you can imagine, to be older, more likely to be single, and more likely to have used substances. So in terms of the relationship between the length of the interpregnancy interval and adverse pregnancy outcomes, here's one sort of representative graph with three adverse pregnancy outcomes. So low birth weight, preterm birth, and small for gestational age all on the same graph. On the x-axis, the length of the interpregnancy interval in months, and the y-axis is the prevalence of those adverse outcomes. And what you can see is this sort of stereotypical J-shaped relationship that gets replicated time after time, where what you can see is that the nadir of the J, the lowest likelihood time for an adverse pregnancy outcome, is probably with intervals between 18 to 24 or 18 to 36 months. On the right side of the curve, longer interpregnancy intervals are associated with sort of a gradual increase in those risks, but the shortest interpregnancy intervals are really where that J-shaped curve sort of takes off and a marked increase in the risk of adverse pregnancy outcomes. Conde Agudelo in 2006 published this great meta-analysis in JAMA looking at 67 articles in both developed and developing countries looking at the length of the interpregnancy interval and their impact on subsequent pregnancy outcomes, and included studies that were adjusted at a minimum for maternal age and socioeconomic status. And they, again, this is sort of a busy slide that's hard to read, but what you can see time and time again for each of these outcomes is that same stereotypical J-shaped relationship, where the nadir is between 18 to 24, 18 to 36 months, and the short side, the left side of the J, is associated with a significant increase in adverse pregnancy outcomes. So we may have all seen sort of this campaign by the March of Dimes, Healthy Babies Are Worth the Wait. And really what this relates to is the wanting to reduce the number of elective deliveries before 39 weeks. But I would argue that this slogan could equally apply to birth spacing, and yet we don't hear nearly as much in terms of social marketing and social media about the impact of birth spacing on pregnancy outcomes. The CDC in 2006 convened its first summit on preconception care and set an agenda for looking at these issues and sort of tasked us all to think about creating a reproductive life plan and helping women to develop a reproductive life plan that may change over time, but allows her to sort of determine what her reproductive life goals are and allows clinicians and public health providers to help her to meet those goals. So towards this end, we conducted a mixed method study, and I'll present some of our qualitative data first and then the quantitative data a little bit later. So we conducted a focus group study of low-income or recently postpartum women, and we explored with them themes related to pregnancy planning, their birth experience, interconception care, and then birth spacing. And what we found was that maternal health and readiness did come up from women as a determinant of their plans for birth spacing. We heard a lot about the role of pregnancy planning, and then also, sort of surprising to us, I mean, we came into it, I think, as clinicians expecting women to talk about access to birth control. Really what we heard from women is that many of them very much wanted to have children very close together. And we heard this theme over and over in our groups called stair steps, of having kids back to back. And we heard a lot more about the role of the partners and the role of family. And then what we were interested in hearing as well was the role of the provider in women's decisions about birth spacing. So just a few representative quotes. So here's a woman who says, "I did research to see what the safest time to do it is, to get this baby part over with as soon as possible, but it's not safe before a year." And another woman who says, "I think medically you're supposed to wait, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 months maybe." And so what this gave us a clue to is that women are thinking a little bit about that there are health implications of getting pregnant close together, but they may be sort of missing the mark in terms of how close they need or how long they need to wait. We heard a lot about birth spacing failures and failures that happened to women by their birth control method. So things happen, even if you're on birth control, sometimes you get pregnant, so why bother? And another one who said, "I use birth control, I had the condom and the morning after pill, so these were my babies." So she had twins, they were meant to be. I mean, I could have chosen to have an abortion, but honestly, I felt like hell, they've made it through 2 rounds, these were just meant to be my babies. So we heard a lot about sort of fatalism and things that sort of, this had happened to women that they were out of their control. And so what that spoke to us was saying that perhaps there's a role for improving women's reproductive self-efficacy, and perhaps that's something that providers can do. We heard a lot about sibling issues. So this woman said, it's like they'll have somebody to play with, so they won't be working my nerves. Like, he can't go to school next year, so they have at least a brother or somebody to play with. I don't regret having my kids so close together. And another who said, "I want my kids to enjoy each other's company as long as possible." And so that spoke to us again about sort of women really wanting to have their children close in age. So here's sort of the meat of the rest of the talk today, is just talking about what they heard from providers. So here our moderator said, "Have any of the doctors talked to you about the best time to wait between pregnancies?" And a participant says, they said, "Don't have sex for 6 weeks." So the moderator said, "Other than that," and the participant said, "Nothing." And so I think that that is really a message that what we're talking about women at the postpartum visit is really very sort of structural and sort of very concrete, is that don't have sex for 6 weeks and here's a birth control method, but we're not really talking more about the long-term horizon. And another woman who sort of similarly said, "Well, they tell you about the 40 days, right? And after that, before 40 days, they tell you that you can't. But that's the only thing. They're not going to tell you, you know what, wait. It depends on if you have an illness. Then they tell you. You can have children at a set time. But if you don't have anything, they can't tell you." So again, women sort of thinking that perhaps it's not the provider role to tell them about birth spacing, that there's not any role for that, only if you are sick and perhaps going to put your health at risk if you have a short interpregnancy interval. But other than that, perhaps the provider shouldn't be talking about birth spacing. So we then used this information to conduct what we called BIALI, so birth intervals among low-income women. I'm from New York, so bagels and BIALIs are very close to my heart, so that's what I knew. And this, the goals of this study were to determine the effect of maternal attitudes, beliefs, and intent for next pregnancy on the occurrence of a short interpregnancy interval, and to look at this prospectively. So we collected data from 250 English or Spanish-speaking women with recent Medicaid-funded births. We assessed their sociodemographic knowledge and attitudes at baseline, and then we followed them up with phone calls every 6 months for 24 months. We tried to follow them up every 6 months. So what I'm presenting here is baseline data, and we are still sort of collecting our longitudinal data, and it was very difficult to sort of keep track of women. This is sort of a high-risk population and very transient. It was hard to sort of, you know, keep our entire population together. But what we tried to assess was sort of to update women's insurance coverage, things like what they were using for family planning at that next call, and whether their birth-spacing intent had changed over time, and whether they'd have a pregnancy event. So we used that qualitative data that I just talked to you about to sort of inform the instrument creation for the study. We assessed about things like fatalism and women's health locus of control, the role of their partner and subjective norms of what their family had looked like and how that informed what they thought about their own birth spacing, how they interacted with the healthcare system, and then for the purposes of what I'll talk about just next is postpartum visit and what happened at that postpartum visit and what was discussed. So again, we had 250 women. The mean age is about 27.1 years, 28% black women, 12% white, 33% Latina, and 7% Asian. And that was really by design. We tried to sort of really enrich for diversity, which wasn't really hard to do in the San Francisco Bay Area. Only about half of the women were high school graduates. 66% had a household income of less than $30,000 per year, and 34% were foreign born. So again, this was sort of a higher risk population. When we asked them what their intent was for their most recent pregnancy, 35% said that they had wanted to be pregnant when they got pregnant, 27% said that they had wanted to be pregnant later, so having a missed time pregnancy, 9% said that they didn't want to be pregnant then or at any time, so an unwanted pregnancy, and 21% were ambivalent. So for that, we had about a 57% risk of unwanted, mistimed, or ambivalent pregnancies. So again, predicting a population that's going to be at risk for subsequent unintended pregnancy. When we asked women how long they wanted to wait until their next birth, the majority of women said, 29% said that they wanted to wait more than 5 years, with a second group saying that they either wanted to wait 2 to 3 years or 3 to 5 years. Only 10% endorsed that they wanted what we thought was a short interpregnancy interval, so less than 2 years, and nobody said that they wanted to have a baby less than 1 year. But what we know about women that look like this, and what we know from this population after having looked at them, is that there are going to be people who wind up in that bucket, and so what can we do to sort of prevent that? So we had 215 women who responded to the question about the postpartum visit. Only about 80% of them had actually had a postpartum visit by 6 to 12 months, again, speaking to the fact that not all women will come for that postpartum visit. Are there things that we should do at the time of delivery or even before patients deliver to help with postpartum counseling? And so when we asked them whether their provider at their postpartum visit discussed each of the following, 95% said that the provider asked them about their current health. How are you doing now? How are you feeling now? About 95% talked about breastfeeding, which is great, whether a woman was breastfeeding or not, but there were questions about breastfeeding. 94% discussed birth control methods, but only 65% discussed plans for a next pregnancy. So that's really to contrast with birth control methods, which are really sort of what are you using now, what, you know, again, in a very concrete way, what can I do to help you today, but not really talking about the longer-term horizon. And then we did do sort of briefly bivariate and multivariate regression analyses looking at predictors of who had these conversations. And what we saw was that Latina women and Asian women were more likely to or at least report that they'd had that conversation at the time of their postpartum visit, as were multiparous women. When we did adjust for other factors, only Latina ethnicity held up as being a predictor. Things that were not predictors in this small study are maternal age, income, education, marital status, social ladder, where women felt their subjective socioeconomic status was, and then interestingly, desire for another pregnancy. So we did sort of stratify by women who said that they didn't want another pregnancy and women who said that they did. It didn't seem to matter. There were still sort of wide differences in whether or not they were asked about plans for a subsequent pregnancy. And I don't take that much away from this multivariable analysis. I actually think that the one thing that we didn't adjust for, which we probably should have, was actually just the two sites at which women had their care. And so we have one site that really was a county hospital, which took care of a lot of Latina, Asian women, a lot of multiparous women, lots of foreign-born women, and the other site that was a academic health center that still had a high-risk population. But what I think this speaks to more, rather than disparities at the patient level, it probably speaks to disparities at the provider level. There's probably groups of providers who are in tune to these issues who will talk to women about these birth-spacing concerns. And what that says to me is that providers are probably very teachable and that this is an intervention that we can actually sort of roll out to providers if we think it's important. So in conclusion, I do think that birth spacing is a modifiable risk factor for adverse perinatal outcomes, and that women are often unaware of the importance of adequate birth spacing, and that it's a place for sort of knowledge improvement. And that the postpartum visit really is sort of this classic time, which at least for us as obstetricians, it's the last time we see patients before they either do or don't come back in the next pregnancy. And that has often been something that's motivated me to do this work, is that oftentimes as a high-risk obstetrician, I see people at the 6 weeks postpartum visit, and then I see them way too soon coming back with a next pregnancy with the same sort of high-risk issues that haven't gotten worked out in interconception care. So I think that we are missing an opportunity to provide health education to women as they are leaving our practices. And that birth spacing and counseling and the creation of a reproductive life plan really should and could be incorporated into routine postpartum care. So I would like to thank my collaborators for this particular study, Ana Fernandez-Lamoth, who is our research associate in California, and Miriam Cooperman, who is my mentor at the University of California, San Francisco. And then thanks to my children, who were somewhat adequately spaced. Actually, when I first started talking about this, I had to go back and calculate my own interpregnancy interval, which was 17 months, 3 weeks. But as we all know as researchers, we can always sort of round up, so we're going to call it 18 months. So thank you very much.